The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
We are going to start this afternoon session with another very distinguished group of panelists. As you can see, and you probably read their bios, I'm not going to delve into their full curriculum vitae, but I'm going to highlight some of the positions that they have held and the expertise that they bring to this table. We're going to be talking, as Mark Thompson very well said it this morning, about how opening places of detention can help prevent abuses. This is a very important aspect of the work of preventing torture and ill treatment. In my own experience working with victims of torture, visits to prisons, visits to psychiatric institutions, visits to different types of prisons that go by euphemistic names like houses for the well-being of children that are actually horrible juvenile detention centers, can actually improve, be exposed, help mobilize the level of state response, the level of shaming and awareness by people on the outside and some of the state institutions by actually entering and exposing what happens in detention places. And we've had significant steps taken by the international community with the coming to be of the optional protocol of the Convention Against Torture, which is recognized as a major stepstone to prevent and help end torture. And we have a fascinating group that brings part of the legal experience. We have Judge Ted Rubin, who has an extensive knowledge of juvenile justice and juvenile justice system. He's currently a consultant, but he has been a judge, a legislator. He has been associated with many institutions. We have Dr. Santiago Candon, who has an incredibly vast experience in Latin America. He's currently the executive secretary of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, but he has also held positions in foundations and intergovernmental organizations that have given him the true expertise, not only in legal issues, but in the Americas. Sitting with us, we also have Dean Malcolm Evans, and he's currently Dean of the Faculty of Social Sciences and Law. He studied in Oxford. He is in Bristol University currently. He has also written worked on issues of public international law, on freedom of religion, and prevention of torture. Sitting with us is also Nora Sveas, who is a vice chair of the UN Committee Against Torture. She brings a very special talent to this group of jurists and activists and officials working on torture. She is a clinician. She has worked extensively with victims. She's also written profusely on torture and trauma. And last but not least, we have the pleasure as well of having Phyllis Geer as well, a member of the UN Committee Against Torture. She has an extensive experience in human rights. She is currently the director of the Jacob Blaustein Institute for the Advancement of Human Rights of the American Jewish Committee. She has been associated with many prestigious human rights organizations and foundations, so further words I'm going to leave you with Judge Ted.
Am I correct? There's no class in juvenile law in this law school? Mike Brett.
Why?
That's really a fairly important area of my life. More than 40 years have been dedicated to this arena. And there's so many cases that keep bouncing into prominence critical of dual institutional care. Now, do no harm is one of our credos, but much harm is done in behalf by good people, really, who over-believe their abilities to restrain young people and save communities is beyond, really, their ability. So there's most of the reports of juvenile maltreatment occur after the fact. This is where getting ahead of this fact to monitoring more effectively is really critical. So this past week, a report, Jackson, Mississippi, the Juvenile Pretrial Detention Center. Detention, you feel, is pretrial. Institutions are post-disposition. But here it was, a juvenile detention center failed to provide detention hearings for children locked up pretrial within the 48 hours mandated by statute. It makes me think it's not good. But in 1995, I had the opportunity to go to El Salvador, visiting their juvenile institution at the back end, and I asked young people there, how long have you been locked up here? They said, 2 to 3 years. I said, what, have you been to the court? They said, no, we've never even been to the court. So I don't want to minimize the problem in Mississippi in failing to get their juveniles before a judge to review the necessity of detention within 48 hours. But they're also locking up, in other words, status offenders, in the term, conduct illegal only for children. The breadth of juvenile codes used to be that if you ran away, you were incorrigible, you talked back to your parents, you were a truant, you were a delinquent. So when I was a judge in the late 60s, I could send this child to the same institutions as readily as an armed robber. Okay? Today, we fortunately put that in a separate category, called pins, chins, mins, yins, and gins. They're status offenders because conduct illegal only for children limits our ability to lock them up. But nonetheless, it gets being locked up illegally in a specific community. And 2 weeks ago, as I was reminded at lunch today, two corrupt juvenile court judges in Pennsylvania, were pleaded guilty in federal court for taking $2.6 million of payments from two private for-profit juvenile institutions in Pennsylvania. Can you read the story?
Yeah.
Really dreadful. Most children without lawyers, and most children are necessarily put away. You see, so we need checks and balances in this field of juvenile justice where I never see a reference to torture, but very often it's ill treatment. Let me say that institutional care is not always bleak. There are juvenile programs that are very good. I should mention, this community, you've had a renaissance of good administration. A person named Vincent Schirotti, who's taken over the D.C. juvenile justice system, is really an excellent person. And so we're having reforms, but still a lot of young people are in jail in this community out in Dakotas, where a good organization, the Campaign for Youth Justice, raised the money to send the parents to visit their children who are locked up in one of the Dakotas because there aren't facilities there here. The principle should be to keep youngsters out of the institutions, and even more, to degree we can, to keep them out of court. Now, it happened that a year ago I was in Cairo, Egypt, where I met APT, Association for Prevention of Torture, competent professionals who were putting on a seminar trying to encourage Egyptian officials to set up monitoring of juvenile and adult offenders who were locked up. And I heard reference there. In the United States, Rhode Island does a good job on this. And here I've been in this field for so many years, but I never knew Rhode Island did a good job of monitoring the care of children in both foster homes and institutions. And so I had to look them up. And indeed, they seem to have one of the more aggressive approaches. Even their terrible state training school, which is gradually being changed over to a new building, but they go there, they have an office there. That's good. And they make unannounced visitations, which is good. And they sit with the girls that were locked up, and they find out that there's not much that we call gender-specific programming for girls. And so they meet with the officials there and say, we need gender-specific training. We found that they do mitigate actively, because their statute authorizes them to do all kinds of things, like mitigating the care of children. And there is, in that state, since 1973, a federal court consent decree on their state institution, which is finally about to be knocked down and replaced. It's the longest standing federal court decree of any state institutional problems. There are numerous state deficiencies brought into federal court, and it was called CRIPA, C-R-I-P-A, the Constitutional Rights of Institutionalized Persons Act, which brings the Department of Justice investigators in to a state if they've heard enough complaints or there's been several deaths of juveniles in institutional care. And so the Department of Justice is really helpful. For example, in Louisiana, if I use the name Tallulah, you think of Tallulah Bankhead, some of the older citizens here. But this is a town in Louisiana I'd never heard of, but Tallulah, Louisiana, where a son of a state senator who was a buddy of a corrupt governor gets money from this legislature to start a private juvenile prison, which is really as bad as can be. So that, you know, the Juvenile Justice Project Louisiana lawyer picked up the investigation by the Department of Justice and brought suits because these young people that were sitting in dreadful facility with virtually no medical care, 1.5 hours of education a day, no dental care, guards, was a for-profit, my biases, hates. I despise private for-profit prisons and juvenile institutions as well. The bottom line is profit, the bottom line is maybe we're trying to care for the children, but to maintain political relations. And part of the rationale they use in getting private prisons, adult or private juvenile institutions, they say we can be able to build a division and we can fund, you won't have to do a bond issue, governor, to do this institution. We will build that into your daily rate so you don't have to advance money, fund, do bonds and pay interest on that. We'll just charge you by day with rates go up. They hire, typically hire poorly trained people, especially in rural areas like Tallulah, Louisiana. But it took about 6 years when we finally closed down this Louisiana facility. It's now a prison. Maybe not much better. But it took a laborious effort, and I had an opportunity to make a talk to one of the judges of Louisiana 6 years ago, whatever. Why do you keep sending juveniles to this terrible place? And they said, we don't have enough in the area of community corrections. And so I said, why not? Well, finally, you've heard of the MacArthur Foundation. They did not give a genius award to Louisiana, but they gave them a bunch of money along with Pennsylvania, Illinois, and Washington to reform juvenile justice in the community. So that this is where we have been trying to take this movement. The original laws of the juvenile courts were always really good. Purpose of the juvenile court then was to maintain a child in its own home or her own home wherever possible, to remove that child only when it's necessary for that child's welfare or that of the community. And if you remove the child, provide that quality of care, guidance, treatment, discipline, rehabilitative efforts to bring that child back into safe conditions. Well, the juvenile court history was very benign until 1965, when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled. Did you find out the name of the case? In re Gault, Gerald Gault, G-A-U-L-T, 367 U.S. 1, the only citation I can give you of a federal court case. But this involved a child, then 15 or 16, on probation in Globe, Arizona, who was on probation for, because he was a kid upstairs in a movie house, had taken a woman's purse when she went to the restroom, took a little bit of money, he was on probation. And then a year later, the sheriff picks him up and takes him to detention because allegedly he and this other boy made a dirty phone call, obscene phone call to a lady, Mrs. Cook. Not a moment of great repute in this trailer in Globe, Arizona. Thereafter followed this no due process. Juveniles committed to the state training school for 5 years. A woman lawyer appealed. The father walks into her office and says, "My Gerald's no angel, but if he says he told me the truth, I believe him." She took the case, took it to the Supreme Court of Arizona, failed there, caught up a lawyer of the ACLU nationally who took the case, resulted in the decision. Justice Fortas writing the decision saying juveniles do indeed have a right to notice of their charges, to the right to counsel, to the right privilege against hearsay and other rights. I became a judge of Denver Juvenile Court a long time ago, 1965. Children then had no copies of anything going. They were charged with this, told you're here, no right to counsel. We've improved on that. Detention hearings were not non-existent then. And E.B. Hall writes, but nonetheless, somehow the juvenile system still incarcerates, locks up children without with limited, often limited due process, often no lawyers, not always, of course, but often, too often, in poor institutions. Now, the problem in monitoring, the states do a little bit of it. Some of the states do a better job. The California Correctional Standards Authority supposedly does in California. I've read some of the reports, but yet the federal court, some state supreme court, state superior court, excuse me, with complaints that they don't do their job. I have a report from Idaho, really, that I've been working recently, where the report is very superficial. At least they did provide it to me. Where they talked of interviewing, they talked the superintendent of the detention centers worried that there'd be no real problems. One attempted suicide was reported. The attempt by boy to cut his wrist, taken to the hospital and treated. But this, they got a report of this. Two juveniles were interviewed, basically superficially. One says, I got good care here, I've been disciplined. The girl says, I've been here for the 10th time. This happens. At least she's there, not in the state training school. She'll be going to drug court. This is one of the problems, of course. And I'm getting a note. I got 4 more minutes, okay? But here, the inspecting staff are all juvenile justice professionals. They all worked in institutions. So they reviewed another juvenile institution. They did not have the medical, mental health, lawyer, citizen that they should have. Such a panel. We now have in the state of Ohio a major lawsuit going on their whole state institutional network. A friend of mine is the federal monitor on that. He does write me that their mental health program has been improving, that they've hired X number of new professionals, and he walked into the mental health unit of the state institution. Better feel. Or staff, or interaction. But still, he says, we've been reducing the numbers of institutionalized juveniles there, but the number of discipline violations has increased. So what's going on? Monitors are to look at the use of force, restraints, education, health care, grievances. And one of the problems in juvenile institutions is that juveniles are often unable to really defend grievances against themselves or bring grievances. Effectively against the institution. So in some summary, okay, juvenile monitoring takes place in U.S. institutions. That which takes place is often superficial. Monitoring is most often pre-scheduled. They know they're coming, they're sent for them, they clean it up, whatever. Again, there are a lot of good juveniles. Let me say, in summary, juvenile court is a heck of a lot better than criminal court. Juvenile institutions are a lot better than criminal. There's still in the juvenile field many, many, many people who care about kids and much really good going on. But I don't want to overemphasize the bleak picture but there's been at least a dozen state juvenile institutions under federal court order for his gross failure to fear deaths and whatever. Anyhow, monitoring is often pre-scheduled. The team that monitors is usually institutional people. Employees of the institution hold off blowing whistles for whistleblowing too long. They're afraid for their jobs or their whatever to inform and complain. Prosecutors are not very interested in inspecting juvenile institutions. In other words, the prosecutors feel they've got a special duty to the community, but they also have a responsibility to justice, and that means trying to make sure that if they put a kid away, he gets really good care, but they don't seem to follow that. Defense counsel ought to often know deficiencies in program, but do little about it. And juvenile court judges, including maybe myself, most of them are really good people, most of them really care, but they do insufficient follow-ups when they put kids in various facilities. So we need preventive monitoring, we need broad-based monitoring. More of that needs to go on. Some is going on under the aegis NEKC Foundation. Many of you heard of their Juvenile Potential Deterrence Initiative, and they're really good people. But still, they're only working 80 jurisdictions, which is good, but still, it's not the United States. Anyhow, thank you very much.
Such studies and reports and reports as it considers advisable in the performance of its duties, urge the government of the member state to supply it with information of the measures adopted by them in matters of human rights, and to move to the territory of any American state when it so decides by an absolute majority of votes and with the consent of the government concerned. So basically, with these three first rules given by the state, the Commission started slowly to work in the protection of people deprived of liberty in the Americas. The first activity regarding this issue was done regarding political prisoners in Cuba. We are talking about 1962, 1963. The Commission back then was not able to visit Cuba, but it holds hearings receiving former political prisoners or family of political prisoners, and produced a report regarding the situation of the detention centers in Cuba after the fall of the dictatorship. The second, the second activity regarding the people deprived of liberty took place in the Dominican Republic. We are talking about 1965. It was the first visit of the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights to the member state. The Commission spent approximately 1 month in the Dominican Republic observing the situation of human rights in general, but giving specific attention to the situation of people deprived of liberty. And in the report of the Commission stated that, noted that the single most negative aspect of the human rights situation in the Dominican Republic was the condition of prisons under the authority of the law. In particular, the overcrowding in some cells, which resulted in degrading treatment or punishment, as well as created some kind of physical problems that should be avoided. As a result of the report of the Commission, at the request of the President of the Commission, many thousands of detainees were transferred to different places and in order to start to resolve at least some of the problems regarding the detention centers. Now, here's one of the rumors that goes back to those years. When the Commission visit of the Commission to the detention center, and the rumor goes that when the Commission gave in advance the place of the detention center they were planning on visiting, and when they arrived there, they came the chain. Some people believe that were not exactly people that had to be detention and were put there by the government to speak nicely to the commissioners about the situation in the detention center. I don't know whether since then, is because of that or that, but the Commission has since then not given in advance the places that the Commission plans to visit. Give a day or a couple of days in advance notice to the government so they know and they provide the information to the facilities so they allow the Commission to visit. In most of these situations, the Commission decided to do this visit, at least in the Dominican Republic and the ones that come afterward, because communications we received from this place. And that was the case of Cuba, that was the case of the Dominican Republic, and that's the case of all the other situations that came after that. The Commission received complaints from people either in the detention facilities or family of people detained, informing of the great situation that people were involved in. Were having in those detention centers. And in all these cases, the Commission, before visiting these places, started to communicate with the government, asking the government for information regarding what was the situation in those detention centers. And through this communication system, the mechanism, the Commission, in some instances, was able to resolve some individual situations, not the overall situation of the detention center, in advance before going. Two of the most important visits of the Commission, specifically regarding this issue, and it also shows what I mentioned before regarding the importance of the independence of the Commission, was the visit to Chile in 1974, in the middle of the dictatorship, right after the beginning of the dictatorship of Pinochet, and the visit to Argentina in 1979, in the middle of the Argentine dictatorship. In both situations, the Commission was session to visit detention centers. Most of the time, many of these cases, the military government were not eager to facilitate those visits, but because of pressure from other governments and pressure from civil society, they had to allow the commission to visit these detention centers. And in these two occasions, it was the first time that it was by an intergovernmental organization, such as the Organization of American States, there was a public discussion in the meeting of this organization regarding the detention center. And it was the first time, at least in the case of Argentina, that it was put at the international level in an intergovernmental organization, how great was the situation in Argentina regarding not only the detention center, obviously, but the situation in China. Another important aspect of the work of the Commission is regarding specific reports. In some occasions, the Commission has written, at least in a couple of the instances, specific reports regarding detention centers. One was a case in Peru, that was approximately 10 years ago, regarding the Chaya Palca prison in Peru, which was a prison that was in such a high altitude that it was completely unhealthy for anybody to be in that situation. Because of the altitude, the detention center of the commission asked the government of Peru to close the Chayapalca prison. It was difficult at the beginning to for the government to start to mobilize some of the detainees. The commission insisted. Slowly, they started to move out some of the detainees. Until a couple of years ago, that almost all of the detainees were moved out. However, according to the latest information we received, unfortunately, not the current government, but that government was already planning to reopen the detention centers. And as of today, I don't know what's the specific situation of that place, but it did have, at least in regarding the public opinion, it did have an impact, the work of the commission in trying to close the detention center. Probably one of the, in my view, one of the most effective way to protect the civil liberty by the Inter-American Commission is regarding the precautionary measures. This is whenever the Commission believes that there is a grave situation, the Commission can ask the government questions to take specific actions to resolve that potential violation. Many precautionary measures granted by the Commission are regarding the people deprived of liberty. There have been some good progress because of precautionary measures, although, as you said, the case of human rights, the glass is always empty, but in Argentina, there is a detention center in the province of Mendoza. The Commission received information on several murders in a couple of months. The Commission requested information from the government. Information given by the government was not adequate enough for the commission, so we granted precautionary measures and we asked the government to take specific action to resolve the problem. After a long process, and we are talking about probably 4 years already, there have been some progress. There is a new detention facility being built in Mendoza province. I hate to recognize that the situation has not been resolved. And in the meantime, several other people have been killed. But at least someone can see that there has been some progress at the government at the federal level, at the local level, to try to resolve the situation by creating new facilities. Let me finish because I'm. Let me finish. Yes, again, sorry, too short of a time, but I want to give a general overview of the situation. Let me finish with some of the challenges we are having right now. The Commission, 2 years ago, asked the U.S. government to allow a visit of the Commission to Guantanamo. The U.S. government initially did not oppose to the visit of the Commission, but at the end, the conditions they put but were not able to be accepted by the commission. And that includes the inability to interview the detainees. So the commission said we cannot the detention facilities because I'm in the standard practice of the commission. We cannot go to the facility if we are not allowed to interview the detainees. And the other case of the relation with the U.S., a year ago the commission asked the U.S. government to permission to visit detention facilities for migrants, which will receive information constantly regarding how great is the situation for migrant workers in these detention facilities. And again, something similar happened. We were accepted to visit, but at the end of the day, the condition imposed by the U.S. government would not be accepted by the commission. So we are now with the new administration trying to see if they change the policy and they allow us to visit the detention facility. The specific case of the detention center, the commission said that we have to give in advance the name of the people who we are planning to interview. And then the report the commission accept that condition as well. I think my time is out. Overall, I would say today the commission, every time that visits a country, goes to the detention facility in that country, sometimes to one, two, or three detention facilities. The last time we visited a couple of weeks ago, we visited Jamaica, and we went to three different detention centers in Jamaica. And in every country the commission visits, in an Interpol visit or a type of visit, we try to visit detention centers. It has been one of the most important activities of the commission over the last few years. There is a special rapporteur for people deprived of liberty of the commission, and it is by far one of the most difficult situations in Latin America, all over the region, in America in general, but particularly in Latin America. It's not one month that passed by without some sort of positive situation in the places, either in Central America, Brazil, Argentina, or We try either through visit or through any of the other mechanisms that we have at our disposal to try to raise the attention, to put in the agenda of the government the great situation people have in detention facilities. Finally, one of the things that we have found that contributes to the problem of the detention facilities is the preventive detention issue. In many of the Latin American countries, at least, we have found that a large percentage of the people in detention facilities, many times, much more than 50%, are people that have been in preventive detention in these facilities, and sometimes for more time than they would get if they are sentenced by the highest so, and in one specific situation, I believe it was in Paraguay, but Claudio Grossman was a member of the commission. The commission visited Paraguay and asked the government to release all these people that were in detention already longer than they would get if they were sentenced. Several hundred people have to be released by the government. So, we cannot always get what we want. But I believe that with the work of the commission, it is definitely to raise the issue of the agenda of the government and in some specific interventions. I believe that the work of the commission has been able to resolve it's a very great situation for the community. Thank you very much.
Opportunity to speak to you this afternoon. One of the difficulties of having listened to so many presentations during the course of the day is that the rather rough notes that I started off with to speak from now are more to a work of art, I think, rather than anything which is a much use for a speaker because they've been scribbled over and annotated so much to say really rather different things in response to so many of the points made. Nevertheless, what I want to do in the time available is to at least attempt to address the question which is posed on the sheet. Expectations of the Subcommittee on the Prevention of Torture, the National Preventive Mechanisms, and the UN Optional Protocol to the Torture Convention. Well, that's about 5 minutes per topic. But we shall see what can be done. As any academic giving a presentation, when you don't know quite what to do, the first thing to do is to deconstruct the question. The moment I saw this, the very first thing I thought was expectations of the long list. Well, the immediate question that came to my mind, whose expectations are we talking about here? Are we talking about the expectations of the states? Are we up looking at the expectations of the bodies themselves, etc., etc.? But indeed, there are a whole host of other questions that we could legitimately factor into this. But you'll be pleased to know I'm not going there. What I'm going to do is to say, well, as Manfred said at the start this morning, this is seen, the optional protocol to the Torture Convention, as being one of the most important new developments relating to torture and torture prevention for many years. I want to reflect on that just for a few moments. New development, well, new to a point, in as much as the idea underpinning the optional protocol owes its origins to more or less the same time as the Convention Against Torture itself, back in the mid to late 1970s. The difference was that whilst the Convention on Torture itself was taken forward in what now looks like a fairly rapid process to conclusion, negotiations beginning in the late 70s and entering and being concluded by 1984. The idea of this optional protocol, which I shall just outline in just a few moments, was conceived in the late 1970s, was tabled alongside the negotiations for the convention itself, but was immediately set aside on the idea that what it was trying to achieve was too far in advance of what could legitimately be expected of the international community at that time. It was premature. It was then reintroduced in 1991, on a draft based by Costa Rica to the then UN Commission on Human Rights, and it was not finally brought to a conclusion until 2002. So it's fair to say that it's taken about 25 years. Now, you might say, well, what does that tell us? It rather gives the lie to the idea, I think, that one could perhaps legitimately be forgiven for taking away from so many of the comments that we've had here today, that it's obvious, isn't it, that monitoring a place of detention actually plays a very important part in the process of addressing torture and inhuman or degrading treatment and punishment. The very history of the evolution of this instrument suggests that this is an argument that has been long fought over before it has finally been won, if it has been won at all. And I think that is an important rider on this. What does the optional protocol require? Well, at one level, it seems remarkably, even breathtakingly simple. The idea is that the prevention of torture and inhuman and degrading treatment can be facilitated by visits of a preventive nature to all places of detention. It's as simple as that. Of course, not quite as simple as that, as we've heard from others and as we well know, if you have notice of such visits, then preparations can be made, etc., etc. So the idea evolves slightly into unannounced visits to places of detention with absolute rights of access to be conducted at short or no notice. Well, the moment you start writing those riders in to an instrument developed in the international domain, one immediately runs into some fairly powerful problems. And I do notice that the heading of this panel is indeed covered with the title Transparency. And it is one of the paradoxes of the international monitoring system which has been created in the optional protocol and indeed in the European Convention for the Prevention of Torture, which was an early product of this line of thinking, is that the price to be paid for access to places of detention by international mechanisms of this nature is indeed a lack of, in some senses, transparency. Confidentiality is the quid pro quo that states have demanded for the creation of these international mechanisms of international experts being able to visit and have access to places of detention, with that veil of confidentiality only able to be lifted by the express consent of the state itself. This in many ways is considerably less transparent than much of what else happens within the human rights world, and indeed considerably less transparent than what takes place at the domestic level in many states, where the reports or outcomes of most monitoring mechanisms are readily available. And this itself shows something about the sensitive, if not controversial, nature of the creation of such mechanisms at this level. I ought to say, if I may, in this context, that much has been said on the focus here of the United States' experience in the international domain, and it must be said that the United States was not one of the most wholehearted supporters of the optional protocol endeavour. Indeed, when the convention was put to the UN General Assembly for adoption, it was one of the four states which voted against, being supported by the Marshall Islands, Palau and Nigeria. actually, you could say slightly worse than the third committee, where the US voted against when it was joined by Syria, Cuba, China, Vietnam, Nigeria, and Japan and Israel. The US has had a long ambivalence in some regards in relation to the genesis and delivery of this. And once again, this underlies the need to continually re-articulate the case for preventive visits to places of detention as an element of the preventive frameworks of torture. Well, what does the optional protocol require? Well, the most innovative element of the protocol in some regards is born out of the negotiating weakness surrounding it. As originally conceived and drafted, what it was designed to create was a single international visiting mechanism, much like that which exists in Europe, the European Convention, Committee for the Prevention of Torture. However, the opposition to a purely international mechanism was such that a compromise proposal was put forward that it should be a dual system, with either an international mechanism or states being given the opportunity to construct their own domestic national preventive mechanisms, which would exercise exactly the same type of powers of visit at the national level. Now, this idea of a choice between the international on the one hand and the national on the other was clearly unacceptable to many of those behind the idea of international monitoring as a preventive means. And so, over time, the two elements drew together to form the composite dual system that we have in the convention at the moment, where we have the international body, the Subcommittee for Prevention of Torture, which currently comprises 10 members, but is likely soon to rise to 25 members when the number of states parties to the instrument rises from its current 44 to 50. And they have the mandate to visit any country party to the system, to visit places of detention as they wish, with unimpeded access. The quid pro quo being that their reports and commentaries are transmitted to the state in confidence and then only are released with the permission of the state. But also, alongside this, an obligation on the states to create or designate a national preventive mechanism or mechanisms which have exactly the same remit of power to access any place where any person may be detained of their liberty by a public authority. Now, this may require the creation of a new instrument, a new body working at the domestic level. It might require the creation of the designation of existing bodies where they already exist within the system. But this twin-track system, which is created by the convention, is certainly innovative and is certainly, fair to say, extraordinarily challenging. The practice to date reveals this. It is challenging on the one hand, because the ability of the International Committee, the Subcommittee for the Prevention of Torture, to fulfil the full reach of its mandate is indeed stretched. In its first annual report published last year, the subcommittee says that it would aspire to visit all countries a party to the instrument on a cycle of around 4 or 5 years. Well, given that there are now 44 states, and it seems only able on the resources available to it to be able to visit no more than 3 or 4 a year, it is clear that aspiration is unlikely ever to be realised. And before one should get too depressive about that, in fact, exactly the same has proven to be true in the European theatre, where the European Committee for Torture, which is far better resourced, has proven itself unable to match its own aspirations in terms of regularity of visiting. So one could say the one thing that states ought not to expect from the International Committee, to revert to the title of this talk, is very frequent visitations from the international body itself. For most working within these systems, it may literally be a once-in-a-lifetime experience as they move through their own systems and structures. What you may, however, expect is a much more detailed attention from the national preventive mechanisms which have been created as a part of the convention framework. The difficulty here is working out precisely what is meant by a national preventive mechanism. And this ties in with one of the most fundamental questions, I feel, that the creation of the protocol has thrown up. And in the literally few minutes available to me, I really want to focus on now, which is what is meant by preventive visits, what is meant by the overall and overarching idea of the concept of prevention. Now, in terms of looking at the types of bodies that deal with or address either concerns within detention facilities in many countries, the easy solution or easy categorization between those mechanisms on the one hand, which are seen as being reactive, such as ombudsman's office, complaints commissioners, etc., etc., but when there are known to be difficulties, will then move in and try to address the problem, as opposed to, on the other hand, what are seen as proactive bodies, those who have a mandate not waiting for a violation or allegations, but on a routine, regular basis to go into facilities to observe the conditions of detention, to observe the way in which people are treated, and to produce an entire raft of suggestions upon how things can be improved. And this bright line division between reactive and proactive certainly is one of the hallmarks of the things that set off a national preventive mechanism relating to torture and ill treatment from those which are, as I say, basically complaints mechanisms. But one needs to understand more about what is meant by the concept of prevention to understand more fully both what the practical operation of the International Committee should be, and also what is to be expected in terms of designation and operation of the national preventive mechanisms themselves. And here, I just want to step back very briefly to just isolate and identify a few trends why I think this development of an overarching concept of prevention, in which we place not only the international visiting mechanisms and the national visiting mechanisms, but the work of the Committee Against Torture itself, the Special Rapporteur, and many of the other instruments should be placed together. And perhaps it should be said in parenthesis, I doubt that there is a single human rights prohibition which has received more attention than any other in terms of institutional mechanisms than torture and ill treatment. But these broader issues, very briefly, are these. First of all, I am a public international lawyer in general, and so we find that if we look at the, for example, judgment of the International Court of Justice in the Bosnian genocide case a little while ago, a very, very interesting observation about the grounds on which Serbia-Montenegro, as it was then, was able to be held liable in that case, not because it was directly responsible for the actions of those who committed genocide or genocidal acts in Srebrenica, but the court tells us for its failure to have done all it could have done to prevent those violations from taking place. In other words, in relation to the Genocide Convention, which, as far as I can see, in relevant terms, is couched exactly the same as the Torture Convention and the Torture Prohibition, we find in general international law the beginnings of the emergence of a general preventive concept. And I think this is really rather important and something that more needs to be done to be to tease out. Secondly, and perhaps distressingly for the Texans, if dare we call it the torture communities, the idea of national preventive mechanisms as means of addressing human rights concerns is becoming more broadly applied. The UN Disability Rights Convention, for example, is now has the equivalent of national preventive mechanisms written into that, and many, in some countries, including my own, are now beginning to reflect on how they respond to that challenge. One of the issues that has arisen in some countries which have already thought to designate national human rights commissions as national preventive mechanisms for the UN torture, for the OPCAT, the Torture Convention, are saying, well, shouldn't we use exactly the same bodies in order to fulfil the national preventive mechanism remit under the Disability Rights Convention and any others which come along? Well, it all depends what you mean by prevention. And it all depends on what you're looking for in terms of delivery against two completely different sets of obligations. And so there is very important work to be done here about understanding, are we talking about a general preventive remit, or is torture prevention something different? And unless there is good thought and work done on this fairly soon, I think confusion may creep in from the practice of states who inevitably, in the interests of, from their perspectives, efficiency and economy, will seek to draw those strands together in something that will end up looking like a single overarching remit tagged on to national human rights commissions, etc., that may simply be ill-designed to achieve the outcomes of either or others which come along. And my final passing shot, because I'm aware of my injunction to self-regulation, which I'm able to impose on the moderator, is a little bit of very recent practice from the United Kingdom. So much has been said about the US and other countries today, it's quite unfair that my own country ought to escape a degree of reflection and censure. And censure is indeed the right wording in my view. Last week, the House of Lords in the UK heard a very important decision from concerning the British policy of deportation with assurances. Deportation with assurances is the British response to what do you do about the situation in which you have individuals who, if you return them, who are foreign nationals, who are believed to be a threat to national security, who are currently within the country, but whom you feel that you cannot return to the country you wish to return them to because of the risk that if they do, they will be subjected to forms of torture and human degrading treatment or other human rights violations. That latter tag is now becoming increasingly important. And in a very interesting and I think very important judgment given by the House of Lords last week, one of the judges in which it was decided it was quite permissible to return a person to Jordan, not where they thought they would be at the risk of torture, but where they thought it was likely that they would be subject to judicial proceedings in which evidence which had been the product of torture would be being used against them, said the following. One of the arguments, that as to external monitoring, a good deal has been written about its importance in enabling a court or other authority to be satisfied that the receiving state is complying with assurances about safety on return. There is no doubt that in the absence of some provision for external monitoring, such assurances may be no more than empty words. But there is no rule of law that external monitoring is required. And what they go on to stress is that what is necessary is some form of verification. And external monitoring of places of detention, visiting mechanisms, are only one possible form of verification that can be set aside on others. And going on to say that the provisions in place were adequate for those purposes, even though they did not include monitoring of that nature. Now, I think this is, again, underlies the reason why it is important to continue to articulate the case and the importance of monitoring places of detention as part of that broader, overarching idea and need to devise a preventive approach and to locate monitoring more firmly in an overall holistic approach to torture prevention, rather than just reducing it to, should we say, specifics of a particular subset of activity. I wish time would allow me to say a lot more on this topic. I'm sure you don't. Regrettably, it is your wish which is going to be acceded to. And so I really thank you for the attention that you graciously paid me so far.
Creation of interlocking law enforcement obligations among states' parties to take steps to bring alleged offenders to justice. From this perspective, the convention can really be seen, as Malcolm Evans has indicated, as a law enforcement measure rather than as an aspirational human rights treaty. And it is the closest to and modeled explicitly on the Convention Against Genocide. Now, these issues that one has to deal with in our committee are thus not abstractions. And the committee began its procedure, we heard a lot about this morning. The committee began its work reviewing reports and providing summaries of those. But then after 1993, it, like other treaty bodies, began to adopt conclusions. It was the only such treaty body that actually was authorized to do so in the text of the treaty. But it began to do so, and after a while, one issued the conclusions and began to ask the question, what results do these conclusions have? Nicely worded, good wordsmithing, but things are not yet finished. As a result of this experience, the committee decided to establish a follow-up procedure. And a follow-up mechanism was created by appointing one of its members to serve as the rapporteur on follow-up for the committee. But the burden was not simply on the rapporteur. The committee members were asked at the end of every review of a country to identify 3 to 5 of its recommendations that were serious, protective, and able to be accomplished in 1 year, giving them a special status for follow-up. Not necessarily the most important of the recommendations. Those might be changing the laws, but those might take several years. But certainly things that were urgent, protective, could be carried out, because after all, the states are required to come in every several years with new reports, and they do. Follow-up procedure was aimed at getting clear-cut results. Well, since we began this procedure in 2003, and as of last year, 67 states had been reviewed by the committee, and follow-up recommendations adopted on all of those. 53 of those states were to have submitted those follow-up recommendations by May of last year. And in fact, 33 of them did. Now, I hang around the UN system. 33 out of 53 sending in voluntary reports on time. Well, more or less on time. 25 of the 33 had them on time. The other 8 came in within 1 to 4 months after the deadline. I mean, that's still pretty good. in the UN system, that's a remarkable response. After all, what happens if they don't send him? All of these measures were adopted in order to give effect to Article 2 of the Convention about adopting effective measures. And in the course of looking over the reviews and the responses, the rapporteur writes back to the countries. She evaluates whether they've actually implemented what they've said they've done and whether more information is needed on these measures. And in the course of that, she's found quite a number of concerns, recurring concerns from country to country. First of all, the need for greater precision on the means by which police and other personnel instruct on or guarantee detainees their right to obtain prompt access to an independent doctor, lawyer, or contact a relative. Secondly, the importance of specific case examples about such access and the implementation of follow-up recommendations. General responses don't in any way satisfy the committee. Third of all, the need for separate, independent, and impartial bodies of the sort that Malcolm was to examine complaints of abuses of the convention. Because, quite frankly, the victims of torture are not going to feel comfortable going to the very authorities who are responsible for torture to seek remedy. So the importance of an independent body in this case becomes extremely significant. And its purpose is very simple, to protect people, and to protect people who are employed in those bodies as well from scurrilous charges and the like. So it works great to have an independent entity. The value, we also found that there's considerable value in precise information coming into us, lists of prisoners, details on deaths in detention and the like. We have seen that there's a need for more vigorous fact-finding and monitoring. We've also found that there are challenges in gathering and analyzing police and criminal justice statistics in many countries. When we ask about them, we don't always get them. And we've also found the protective value of prompt and partial investigations into allegations of abuse, for example, by parliamentary ombudspersons or the unannounced inspections, whether they're by a national body or an international body. We're also convinced that there is, from country to country, need for police training, the clear-cut instructions on the prohibition of torture, information on the conduct of medical examinations, including autopsies. And we want to know things like whether they're actually required to document signs of torture, sexual violence, and whether they are required to preserve evidence. We often find that these are not the case. So we've also seen a lacunae in statistics, including whether there's been disciplinary action against police officials and other officers and relevant personnel. Now, we found all this out. What does this do for the prisoner? What does this do for the torture victim? And how does this impact the effectiveness of the transparency of these procedures? And what does it say about the role of independent experts? Well, we think what it says is that UN bodies need to keep focus on follow-up. Follow-up is a UNese type term. It really means impact. And in order to assess that, we need to have better ways of measuring what we've accomplished. What are the causes and effects of our recommendations? Will the government come and acknowledge in these written reports to us or in their oral presentations that they have changed their procedures because of our conclusions? Or will the changes in any way be visible or not? So we're looking for patterns of action, for patterns of neglect, that we can identify and change to through continued monitoring and continued pressing of the state's parties. Now, I've struggled with the question of how we could improve our results. We already are identifying some of the conclusions as having a certain priority, not because necessarily the most important, but because they're urgent and doable, accomplishable, and protected. But there's a serious question about whether we should be ranking our recommendations in terms of importance, limiting the number of them significantly, and perhaps only identify 4 or 5 actionable items for every country quite specifically. Another question is whether we should be focusing on these issues and only these follow-up issues in the next review that's undertaken. Whether we should take example from the Inter-American Commission, the Violence Against Women Convention and the Corruption Convention, which have follow-up procedures that are integrated into the process that follows on. Whether we should use the kinds of questionnaires that they use to make sure that every country gets asked the same set of questions and is required to come back with acceptable answers. We don't always do that. We vary our questions and our inquiries according to the situation affecting the country that we're dealing with. Now, we also don't have any outcome. We could be listing the countries as to whether they meet whether they comply with the conclusion, fully, partially, or not at all. We don't do that. We could be doing that in order to put a little more pressure on the states, public exposure being what it is. I don't think anybody would like to be in the bottom of those lists. Didn't do things. And finally, there is this question that Michael Evans brought up of preventive mechanisms. Should we perhaps be developing indicators? Indicators that we can go after that can shape our evaluations and our follow-up. The whole purpose is, as I said earlier, to have impact and to protect people. We think that at this point in time, there's much to be learned. But those of you who are interested can look on the committee website, and it's pretty much all the way to the right of the charts by each country. You'll find the follow-up responses from countries, and you'll find the letters from the rapporteur about follow-up. You'll see the kinds of issues that have been asked about, very detailed problems, prisoners, deaths in detention, the need for autopsies, the need for protective measures of many different kinds. I would like to learn from your observations what you think we should be doing next in order to be more effective in terms of having an impact.
The 24. before, or the television, which I think really could have the undertitle Poetry Works, because in every discussion, and this debate has, and I would say the 24 hours discussion has also come to Europe, and I think we meet quite frequently in discussions on the absolute prohibition against torture, that, well, there are indications that torture is working. So again, if anything can be done to the way that torture is portrayed in the public arena, it would be important. And I think we all have very important work to do in relation to this. My focus here today now will be on two issues, namely the relationship between health and torture, that is, on torture as a serious threat to health in the widest sense of the word, including quality of life, meaning, and human integrity, and also the important role of health professionals in all endeavors to prevent torture, to detect torture and in treatment, both in persons and in systems, and to deal with it in the aftermath, in the context of treatment and rehabilitation, as well as in the context of reporting and claiming reforms and accountability. As so very clearly expressed by Mark Schneider in his luncheon address to us today, torture always leaves scars. Not always the kind of scars that are visible to others or necessarily noticed by others in the daily life, but there will always be scars. In the mind, as intrusive memories, nightmares, feelings of loss and humiliation. And there will be bodily scars. Even when these have grown, the body remembers the pain, and one of the long-term consequences of torture is related to this. How events, new situations, movements or physical contact, and sensations in relation to sounds or visual stimuli may bring the torture back, and the pain back, into the body and into the mind. So even if people do manage to live a daily life in their families and in communities, there will be, and phrasing the song, there will always be something there to remind them, and this can come very quickly and it comes very strongly. The actual infliction of pain, be it attacks on the body or systematic destruction of dignity and meaning, often takes place under conditions that themselves may be regarded as torture or ill treatment. And we are not necessarily talking about the situation that at first glance may seem brutal or destructive, as would, for instance, small and dirty cells that have been mentioned here several times, bad sanitation, poor food or temperature regulation. I'm also referring to things like communication with persons deprived of their liberty. For instance, severe lack of information or confusing and contradicting information given, negative and degrading talk, exposure to false or impossible choices, extreme passivity, lack of human contacts, demands or questions being ignored or overlooked, disrespectful and humiliating treatment as part of the daily activities, for instance, surrounding food delivery and toilet visits. All these events contain elements that are systematically used in psychological torture, but they're not always easy to detect at first glance, compared to some of the other problems first described. But nevertheless, long-time exposure for these kinds of stimuli represents serious psychological hazards that may be detrimental to psychological functioning. And these situations, or examples of degrading ways of handling people, can well be found in situations where there is not actual torture taking place, but where the conditions, the insecurity created by such means, the disrespect and humiliation can amount to treatment that in all ways violate human rights principles. And this may be found in prisons, in asylum centers, in psychiatric hospitals, even in places or countries where one expects that such things do not happen. And the danger lies in the fact that this kind of violence does not easily lend itself to registration and observation. And situations such as these that I've mentioned, ranging from intentional infliction of pain with specific purposes and the creation of environments that lend themselves to ill treatment and severe disrespect, can cause a lot of serious reactions in the person, such as helplessness, feelings of total disempowerment, remember, have a special rapporteur today particularly focused on the lack of control and disempowerment. The creation of severe anxiety and hopelessness that may affect the lives of persons for years. And furthermore, the feelings of worthlessness, problems of trust, difficulties in creating relationships, and constant exposure to intrusive memories are events that do change the way which life and stresses are perceived, and often also the way in which pain is experienced. And torture may render people more vulnerable in the aftermath. These all forms the grim picture of the torture sequela that we have been speaking about today. I find it important to focus also on these aspects. And this implies that not only the health condition may be seriously damaged after torture, but the more global aspects like integrity, dignity, self-respect, and meaning in life undergo changes. When reactions after tortures are considered, and particularly when the person undergoes psychiatric diagnosis, many of these aspects that I have referred to are not sufficiently covered or described in psychiatric or psychopathological terms, as we know, and psychiatric diagnosis. And this is also why the application of psychiatric diagnosis in torture cases has often been criticized for medicalizing and reducing social, political, and ethical problems into medical and individual problems. Nevertheless, the many studies done on the effects of torture using the available and internationally applied diagnostic procedures show that persons exposed to torture show reactions that meet the criteria for post-traumatic stress disorder, for anxiety, excitement disorder, and depression, and furthermore, that there is a high level of comorbidity, that means that especially between PTSD and depression, meaning that the same person may fulfill the conditions for several disorders at the same time. Studies also show that these reactions, implying often severe pain and feelings of inadequacy and intrusive memories, may last for many years after the actual torture has happened, underscoring perhaps also the vulnerability for stresses in the aftermath. Studies of traumatized Cambodian refugees 20 years after resettlement to the US, or Bosnian refugees 14 years after torture, and a number of other similar studies are serious reminders that health services and the like are needed for a long, long time. But such studies are also able to tell us about factors that may moderate such sequela, such as social support, work and meaningful activity, healthcare and rehabilitation programs, etc. And we're also waiting for more evidence as to the effect of justice and the health, on health in the aftermath. We think, and I'm convinced that it is important, but we still lack perhaps good enough studies to document this specific point. But I'm sure it will come. Today we have discussed the many legal aspects of torture, but I'd like to again to point to the importance of the health personnel in this work. And as it's said here, it is a requirement under the convention that also health personnel is acquainted with the legal provisions, but also with the importance of instruments in order to fulfill its obligations to investigate and to document cases of torture. I think this is very important. And if one looks through the questions that are posed to state parties that are considered under the torture convention, these are some of the questions that are raised quite often. And as you see, I also here mentioned the Istanbul rules. I'll come back to those in a moment. But these have also been referred to now in the general comment to Article 2 of the Convention Against Torture. And I also take the opportunity to refer to this publication, which is a very good by MPT, about the role of the physicians and other health personnel in this important work of prevention. So I want to take the opportunity to encourage you to get them. I know you brought them, and to read it. It is a very good work. There are many conditions that have to be in place in order for the health professionals to be able to do the work that is required for them as a part of the prevention against torture. And one of them is that there has to be both information of and respect of ethical, professional ethics. And I will underline the importance of ethics in this work. There has to be the necessary expertise in order to deal with this, both psychological and somatic, because as I tried to imply in my first words that I said, it's important not only to be able to detect the somatic and the physical signs of torture, but the psychological in the person as well as in the environment. There has to be access to all places of detention where persons are held, and also conditions that permit medical and psychological examinations. And this is particularly important because it's not only a room that's secluded from anything else, it's also time. Time and the ability to create alliance and trust. Because people exposed to torture are very often more anxious and more reluctant to talk than other people. And the whole process of being able to create an atmosphere in which these things can be reported is very, very important. And it takes time, skill, and of course, a physical condition, a place to be. There has to be good reporting procedures. Again, I refer to the blue book, and possibilities to respond with medical and psychological care and other necessary changes and follow-up procedures. I will now, in the minutes are left, focus particularly on ethics, professional skills, documentation, and training. Ethics. Despite the old principle of do no harm as imperative in all health professionals, we know that doctors, nurses, psychologists have been involved in torture for many years and in many different cases, situations, be it directly in acts of torture or as supervisors or consultants to those who are inflicting pain, or as part of teams monitoring and advising on harsh interrogation methods. Many initiatives have been taken also among professionals, health professionals, to counteract this particular bad news of our profession. And, for instance, the book Breaking of Body and Mind, many years ago, was exactly focusing the many documented situations of personnel actively involved in torture. In 1975, the World Medical Association adopted the Tokyo Declaration, stating that, and I quote, "The doctor shall not countenance, condone, or participate in the practice of torture or other forms of cruel, inhuman, and degrading procedures, whatever the offense of which the victim of such procedures is suspected, accused, or guilty, or whatever the victim's beliefs or motives, and in all situations included armed conflict and civil strife." This was World Medical Association in 1975. The Tokyo Declaration has recently been updated, but it's again an important position from health personnel. And in the same way, the UN principles on medical ethics relevant to the role of health personnel, particularly physicians, in the protection of prisoners and detainees against torture and other cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment or punishment, was adopted by the General Assembly Resolution in 82, offers explicit guidance for all health personnel, underlining the duty to protect health and provide treatment. It also states that it's a gross contravention of medical ethics, as well as an offense under applicable international instruments for health personnel, particularly physicians, to engage actively or passively in acts which constitute participation in, complicity in, incitement into, or attempts to commit torture or other cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment or punishment. Despite these important declarations, and there are a few others also, if one looks into the particular codes of ethics of health personnel in the different countries, look up the national ethical codes of professionals, there's very little reference to torture and the prohibition against torture and ill treatment. It comes indirectly very often. And many of us are working very hard now at an international level to try to have this much more directly included in the codes of ethics of the profession in order to make this very clear. You cannot come around it. And of course, again, the discussion that has been in this country, in the APA, about the psychologist, has of course been a reminder that this is a very important question. We know that in the US and also in England, both the doctors and the psychiatrists formulated very clear stances against participation in and in cases of terror suspects. Where nevertheless chose another position and through the work, for instance, of the Presidential Task Force on Psychological Ethics and National Security, the so-called PEN report, was aimed at clarifying ethical guidelines with respect to psychologists' participation in national security matters, and they endorsed psychological or psychologists' participation in the national security issues by monitoring interrogations of terror suspects, advising interrogators on how best to obtain information from prisoners, and being part of the so-called behavioral science consulting team, often called BISCIS. And we all know that this debate has been very, very strong in the APA and also on an international level. And I know that the APA, in their last meeting in August last year, again formulated a resolution, all the time moving further against these positions, but nevertheless, there's still some meters, yards, steps to go. Nevertheless, it is an international challenge for all professional organizations to develop a code of ethics that explicitly reiterates absolute prohibition against torture, and where violations of this not only are dealt with by professional bodies, but also handled in the context of law, which was one of the discussions that I had the opportunity to discuss with the president of APA last year, namely that it's not only a matter for the professional associations to say or to give people a letter saying that they have transgressed some ethical codes, it's also something for the legal system. It has to go beyond the professional needs themselves. I will now try to move to some of the professional skills and contribution from research, because we know that research... 3 minutes? just very... There's a lot of important information in the research on PTSD. It's very interesting for me, who usually lives in the health group environments where PTSD is actively spoken about. We've been talking about kind of events that may cause PTSD without having discussed the PTSD particularly, which so I thought I'd just say some very few words about this. There has been over the years a lot of focus on the post-traumatic reactions people have after extreme stresses. The PTSD diagnosis, which was new as with this name, but it wasn't new as a clinical symptom, of course, that has been observed since World War I. But the interesting thing was that it was the returning war veterans that were looked upon and given this diagnosis. But even despite this beginning, a lot of the research on PTSD has been on single event trauma, which means that some of the cases that we deal with who have been tortured in prison for a long time under very different kinds of extreme stresses are not very well covered in some of the literature. This is fortunately being changed now, so much more focus is on what we will call the complex PTSD. There are What I'd like to say now, towards the end of my talk, is to look into two things. One is the necessary assessment, and again, research has given us a lot of assessment tools in this field in order to assess for therapy, for intervention of different kinds. But there's one particular kind of assessment that has a different aim, namely documentation, and the need to develop manuals for documentation of torture has been given a lot of weight, and the so-called Istanbul Protocol that I mentioned briefly in the beginning is one of those instruments developed particularly for this purpose. And it's not primarily in order to assess people for therapy, it is to use as a document for national procedures, for international procedures, in asylum cases, etc., to document very closely the effects both physically and psychologically. And not only is there such a protocol with a manual saying how this can be conducted, there are also reference material guiding the professionals. But this is something that has to be trained, and I would therefore focus particularly on the importance of training and knowledge to the professional groups to deal with this kind of work. We have the Istanbul Protocol as perhaps the most important one, and it's endorsed by the High Commissioner for Human Rights. And what you see, there are a lot of other guidelines that have been developed to guide professionals in their detection and documentation of course, in order to do this, we need training. Not only a 2 days course, we need training, supervision, and ongoing support professionally. And I think it is a very important part of the state party's obligations to prevent torture is to provide sufficient training for personnel to detect and to document, but also to set into motion treatment and therapy for those groups that are in need after torture and in treatment. And I just want to finalize by referring to a webpage where we have put together a lot of information very relevant in the field of health and human rights, and there's a card outside that you can get. Well, I think I just stopped this here. A lot more could be said, but I hope that at least I tried to convince you that this part of the world, namely strengthening the health professional role and participation in the prevention, is an issue of high priority.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much to the panelists, Ms. Phyllis here, Ms. Green. And because of the time, we're going to take a couple of questions. I know that the presentation has been very stimulating, and I feel bad about having the role of moderator and having to rush you through, but... Yes, and can you identify yourself and say yes?
I'm Alden Bronstein, the president of Penal Reform International in the United States, the director emeritus of the National Prison Project of the American Civil Liberties Union. And a footnote to this very important last conference session, especially the remarks of Dean Evans. One of the things that came out of Abu Ghraib, that mess, was the recognition or the awareness that we are the only Western nation in the United States. By Western nation, I include Western Europe, Canada, but not Central and South America. We're the only Western nation that does not have a system of independent outside inspections of prisons. About 3 years ago, Penal Reform International began the process of trying to educate the United States about this. It had first Ann Owers, Her Majesty's current inspector of prisons and detention facilities in the UK. We had Sir David Ransbottom, our prior expert here. Got a lot of attention. We sponsored a conference with two law schools, AU. In Texas, of all places, on a two-day conference on the use of independent inspection. We had Ann Owers there, Sylvie Cassar, the EU's inspector. We had the Swedish ombudswoman and the former Dutch ombudsperson, the Canadian inspector general who inspects all jails and prisons, and 14 state directors of corrections came to the United States. And after that, the American Correctional Association invited me, knowing that I would speak about that subject, invited me to speak to them about that at their midwinter conference. The most important thing, which some of you may know, and many of you will not, is that last August, the American Bar Association adopted a policy, which means that it can now be cited as their authority, and they will file an amicus brief in an issue involving that the policy calls for the independent outside inspections of jails, prisons, immigration detention facilities and juvenile facilities in terms of every jurisdiction in the United States. That is now ABA policy, and I think I've been working in this field for 50 years. I don't think I'll need another 50 years to see independent inspection happening in the United States.
Are you the Al Bronstein who for years led the ACLU prison project? I would salute you. Thank you for all your great work, really.
I have a question. Okay. I have a question of the impact of events on this issue of extraordinary condition. The decision by the lordship and cabinet. The decision I have taken in the committee is that the extraordinary condition violates Article 3. There are no diplomatic issues. And again, what diplomatic assurance? I mean, if you send a person to a country where you have systemic torture, what are the diplomatic assurance? I mean, besides, we need to go, as it is said in phenomenology, to the fact themselves. We know that sending people to this country was part of the policy of sending them to countries to be tortured. And supervisory organs, they cannot say that they don't know what they're doing. These diplomatic assurances, in most of the cases, have been extinguished. No, we send you to the country where there is torture, but sign please this paper that you won't torture this person. We know also that we have the, you send the person, you know, to Chile, to Chile, you know, you send it to, I'm mentioning examples in the past because of my current position in the committee. But you see, what assurance? External supervision of what? I mean, this person will be told, if you don't do this or that, will rape your daughter or your mother or whatever. And then this person, that is external supervisor, by come by Sweden. They go there and say, have you been tortured? No, I have not. I mean, this is, I don't think that it survives the test of reading. You know, so also you have strengthened that by, so when you are saying we need to supervise more prisons in order to avoid that when there is diplomatic assurance and there is a violation of the prisoners, you need to come out very strongly against diplomatic assurances and the violation of Article 3, and that's the only solution. Again, these are some opinions that will be interested in. Now, of course, as part of normal, you know, and there has been a perversion of normal extradition law, sometimes you seek diplomatic assurance that, you know, if in a country you don't have the death penalty, that the death penalty will not be imposed. But if you have well-founded reason that torture takes place, it's pretty evident that a piece of paper or going every day. You know, we solve any problems. I mean, when I avoid the torture, I think this is of a naivete in the best case and other objectives that are more proper in the way.
Should I? Are these on? I'm obviously not going to dissent from what you say, because my personal view coincides very, very closely with yours. Of course, from a policy perspective, as you mentioned towards the end, there is a little bit of a dilemma, because of course in many walks of life, and not diplomatic assurances are used on a routine basis to justify what would not ordinarily take place. The most obvious example is a return under extradition law of a person to a country where they would otherwise face the death sentence. And, you know, there's no way the UK, for example, would return a person to a jurisdiction to face which still retained the death sentence, but for the assurance given that in this particular instance they won't, you know, the legal circumstances notwithstanding. So I can understand why there has to be a degree of caution about, shall we say, writing off the significance of diplomatic assurances full stop. But of course I would argue that the situation concerning an assurance around the imposition of a particular legal sanction as a result of a process of law is of course very, very different from the circumstance that we're dealing with here. You know, that being said, the position that you outline, as I'm sure you're aware, is somewhat different from the position advanced, for example, by the European Committee for the Prevention of Torture on this, which has taken the view which perhaps holds open perhaps more prospect of engagement and discussion than the perhaps more absolute is it can't work, which is that we cannot rule out the possibility that diplomatic assurances will reduce the real risk sufficiently to mean that a return can be safe. But in order for that to be effective, there has to be a very high level of, shall we say, procedural guarantees around those assurances. And of course, it's an open question about whether, when they're evaluated, one can ever be appropriately assured as to make them real. It's a little difficult in the European context, of course, to take the more absolutist approach simply because the European Court of Human Rights itself in relation to Article 3 non-refoulement, has accepted the efficacy of assurances of that nature in some instances to reduce the risk in a way that makes that return acceptable. So it does mean that there is a difficult line to steer here, which I... And this is what depresses me about the House of Lords' recent judgment, is that, shall we say, it plays down the guarantees and the assurances. And in conclusion, the one thing I think that is interesting and worrisome about the House of Lords' judgment is, in a sense, it ruled out the arguments that you and I know that the Special Rapporteur has advanced almost automatically, in as much as the technical legal ground for the case moving forward was that the lower courts had made an error in law in not taking account of, giving credence to the idea that diplomatic assurances could reduce the risk in that fashion. That was accepted by the Court of Appeal. In the House of Lords, what they said was that this was beyond the jurisdiction of the Court of Appeal to make that decision because it was simply a question of factual assessment, not a question of law. In other words, the argument that as a matter of law, diplomatic assurances could not reduce the risk is simply untrue, and it's simply a question of factual evaluation on the facts of each case. And in that context, they didn't even seem to think that effective visiting mechanisms were a necessary element of that framework. So I think it's a fairly depressing judgment from those positions.
I think we're on time, so I would invite Dean Overall.
We did not talk about follow up in terms of the individual cases. Certainly that is an area that would deserve further consideration. Another area that I think is very important is the fact that training is not something restricted to people that are directly involved. Now, the role, for example, of the television, I think, is an excellent presentation. And then again, what should we have a follow-up and conference on the interaction between the TV, radios, and so on, and how the role in training? I mean, do we need to broaden the scope of training somehow? And what is the role of the mass media on this? I think that would be something interesting. There is a resource. I mentioned that when I was in the Carrera Commission, and I feel the same sometimes, we were confronted regularly with this choice. What case you take, what do you do? Because, it's not like a marriage, you have to decide which person will die. You don't have enough resources. Now, from that perspective, can we coordinate better with the regional working organization? For example, under CAD we have this ability to perform confidential there was perhaps the Inter-American Commission in this region better equipped to some of this, to perform some of this. In the European context also now we're creating OCCAT with the development of OCCAT, and as it was mentioned here, we will have to visit I don't know how many countries. I think it's the question of resources we can render. Because it's good to establish good practices and perhaps to go to some countries that have a good system will be a way to publicize things that need to happen. But there are decisions there that need to be overcome. I mean, in the sense of where what are the priorities. I think the issue of coordination becomes very important because of the lack of resources that the supervisory organs have. Then, incorporation of obligations into domestic grants. I think that is essential. This period now we continue to allow the majority to play a role with the ratifications of the national system. Of course, it's better that somebody ratifies because there is not a legal binding. But all this construction that allow countries to say, yeah, we ratify, but internationally responsible, but we don't apply. It reminds me a little bit of what happened with the Spanish colonists in Latin America. They was for the best. Let me see the column. They will get the laws from the King of Spain, they will put it on their head, and they will say, we respect it, but we don't apply it. And it led to a tradition of this regard to the rule of law. I would not apply it, and I would not have respected many of these laws. But to a certain extent, we all feel that this dichotomy, we ratify something that says, you will not torture. No, yes. No, and then, saying, a judge cannot apply the internet. No, there are all these type of construction that will not allow at the end this instrument to be effective. And I think that we need to continue the dialogue, sharing experiences on the issue of the domestic application. And then, again, if you cannot go to a judge and apply something, I know that International Law Commission is in a very serious, as a part of a very serious effort in order to establish principles that will limit this possibility. And in academia, civil society, we need to continue about this. Because, again, sometimes we see clearly the treaty has been ratified. More than an effort of compliance, is like hiring somebody to find loopholes in order not to apply. We need to start talking more about this. I think we have the work to do in terms of the follow-up. The follow-up is always crucial. Let me finish this with a small story. When I worked with the American Commission, I was exposed to a situation in Central America where a dictator said, I don't know why people complain that there are no free elections. Everyone can run for office. Everyone can advertise. Everyone can vote. The only thing I do, he said, is to count the votes. For the rest, everyone can vote. So, as we take the law seriously, and try seriously, it's important that we move ahead on the count. Well, I want to invite Mark also to share some thoughts and thanks again to him and to APP for being forward.
Thanks, Carlo. I'll be brief. I don't know about you, but I learned a lot today. I work on prevention every day, and yet there was a lot that I learned from today's discussion. I think we were very privileged to have the collection of people who came together today. And as I said to Claudio at lunchtime, when we thought about doing this meeting, we drew up a wish list of people that we'd like to have here. And I would say 80 to 90% of the people who we wanted to come came. So we were very lucky. I thought the presentations were excellent. I thought the panels were very interesting. And you're probably all wondering, though, that we've achieved our first objective, which was to be better informed of the clinical approach. But how do we remember all the variety of things we've heard today? And the good news is that there are several students from WCL who voluntarily agreed to write up a report. So I'd like to thank them on behalf of the co-organizers for doing that very valuable work. It will be a particularly important service for everybody who's participated. And hopefully will also serve to instruct others on some of the considerations and very rich presentations we've had today. And related to that, my second objective, which I pointed out this morning, was to foster improved coherence. Well, it's a little bit too early to say whether we've achieved much or not, but at least I think we planted some seeds there, and maybe the report that comes out this meeting can help. But certainly, I think I have certainly some ideas which, as Claudio was mentioning, we now have to consider some aspects that require particular attention, especially, for example, for those of you living in this country who may want to look at some of the aspects that came out today. I agree with some of those ideas that Claudio mentioned, but one of them is the very interesting litigation experience of ACLU. I think that would be maybe particularly interesting to have a whole day going through that in more detail. Of course, it may require different type of audience, different type of participation as well, getting more people from the judiciary involved. But that is actually a very interesting model for other countries as well to follow, how ACLU and other organizations have used litigation. And I think that could be an issue where we could maybe do more work and get more people from the judiciary involved. I also said that we were hoping to facilitate increased coordination on this issue of prevention. I think going on from Claudio's comments now, but also from the last panel as well, really we understand that coordination comes about by first of all meeting each other, finding out more about what other people are doing. And in a sense, coordination is really common sense after. Once we hear more about what people are doing, it is really coordination falls into place. We do have to be working together, so we need to be bringing in certain expertise and not trying to do the work of others, but to make sure that their contributions are being made full use of, are being applied to a joint, a collective effort to see how we can be more effective in prevention. And I added as well this morning that another add-on objective of today's meeting was to see whether we may have some influence on current US thinking. And I hope that we've achieved some success on that front. And I'm pleased to let you know that tomorrow there will be a meeting of US-based non-governmental organizations looking at how to move forward on the offshore protocol. How can US organizations do more work to lobby for ratification of the offshore protocol? And I'd like to finish on that note, because I think the offshore protocol really does offer us, as the special rapporteur mentioned, and also some very interesting and encouraging perspectives for the future. Not only does it introduce this aspect of national prevention mechanisms, that will visit regularly all places of detention whenever they wish, but it also opens up debates, public debates, to go back to Laura's point, about how important it is to be challenging public views on torture treatment. And in the process of establishing national preventive mechanisms, or even before that, when they're looking at ratification, we've witnessed a very constructive process of states not only looking at how they're going to visit places of detention, but what do they have in terms of their legal frameworks. And in many countries, it's opened up debates on criminalization of torture in a way that we haven't seen by all the other pressure that's come from national organizations, from international bodies, such as a regular recommendation of the committee is criminalized torture. But it's the debates on the offshore protocol that has opened up a more serious consideration of how they criminalize torture. And in a country, for example, like Benin, that is ratified the offshore protocol, they're now moving past this phase on criminalizing torture. In fact, they are regarding the national pledge. And I could cite other examples around the world where we've seen increased interest and serious advances on the criminalization of torture. And that's a massive improvement on the situation of just a few years ago. The other aspect is the fact, the sheer numbers of how many states have ratified or signed. Within a couple of years, we would have the majority of countries under the members of the United Nations that have either signed or ratified this agreement. And that's a very impressive change. And I think it's a term, we've heard the term today in many cases of paradigm shifts, etc. But that is a remarkable shift. At a time when we've seen many setbacks in terms of the principle of the absolute prohibition, we see also this impressive advance on states being prepared to move further forward on this important obligation under the Convention. They already have that obligation to prevent torture and treatment. The offshore protocol offers some solutions on how to move forward. And we now have 44 states that have ratified. We expect that to go up to 50 this year. And as I said, I think in a couple of years, certainly the majority of the states would have. And that, I think, is cause for all of you to feel that there is really a movement in the right direction. Clearly, we've got a lot to do, and clearly this issue of torture and treatment is, unfortunately, a violation which, if we're not careful, can easily slip back into the practice of how people detain, interrogate, etc. And we have to keep an eye on this. We have to work systematically. And therefore, to come back to the objectives of today's meeting, I think we've made a small contribution, and I would like to thank Claudio and Jennifer and the rest of the team here. I think that the organization, by the way, the team who've been doing all the work around at the back, has done an excellent job, and the Cardio people express my appreciation for their work. We certainly would be very happy to do other work with you in the future. We're not the only people who can work on this issue. I think we've identified today WCL, a host of potential partners in the future, and we'd be happy to be invited to organize other meetings in the future and to those activities. On that note, I'd like to thank all of the participants, and I hope that this will lead to some serious progress. As Carl has mentioned on several occasions today, it's part of the process, but it seems that the conference today has helped us in that process to move forward.
I would like to ask Jennifer De Lorenzo to stand up, please stand up, you know, and I'll be talking to you. She's a lawyer that's coordinating that with the project in this culture. Also, our Office of Special Events is really in the hot seat in the spring. Because of the strategic vision of this institution, we have over 60 events in the spring on. Addressing every issue you can imagine and not imagine. And I want to thank Jennifer Dawson, Amit Tejani, Denise Hassi, and Damien Rogers. And thank you for the you mentioned Mark, it's the famous book, I mean, Spanish literature of Jose Cesar. Por el camino de la gozada, en vez de road that day, and I'm afraid that the road will be continuing. We don't get it. But the optimism and the strength of the important values we have talked about here and the determination to continue is a very important learn from this.